And this is Telling Tales with Ms. G. Happy New Year! It's never too late to say that. I have a story for you tonight by one of my favorite authors, Theodore Agos. So, I'll give you a chance to get settled and come right back in like a minute, because this is a good one, here at KTOO 104.3 in Juneau. I'm back. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G, and I have a story tonight from Theodore Agos. It's titled England Under the White Witch. It is always winter now. When she came, I was only a child in ankle socks, my hair tied back with a silk ribbon. My mother was a seamstress working for the House of Alexandra. She spent the days on her knees, saying, "Yes, Madam has lost weight. What has Madam been doing?" When Madam had been doing nothing of the sort. My father was a photograph of a man I had never seen in a naval uniform, and medal was pinned to the velvet frame. My mother used to take me to Kensington Gardens, where I looked for fairies under the lilac bushes or in the tulip cups. In school, we studied the kings and queens of England, its principal imports and exports, and home economics. Even so young, we knew that we were living in the waning days of our empire, that after the war, which had taken my father and toppled parts of London, the sun was finally setting. We were a diminished version of ourselves. At home, my mother told me fairy tales about Red Riding Hood, Never Talk to Wolves, Sleeping Beauty, Your Prince Will Come, Cinderella, Choose the Right Shoes. We had tea with bread and potted meat, and on my birthday there was cake made with butter and sugar that our landlady, Mrs. Stokes, had bought as a present with her ration card. Harold doesn't hold with this new empress, as she calls herself, Mrs. Stokes would tell my mother. Coming out of the north, saying she will restore us to greatness, she's established herself in Edinburgh, and they do say she will march on London. He says the king got us through the war, and that's good enough for us. And who believes a woman's promises anyway? But what I say is, England has always done best under a queen. Remember Elizabeth and Victoria? Here we are, half the young men dead in the war, no one for the young women to marry, so they work as typists instead of having homes of their own, and trouble every day in India, it seems. Why not give an empress a try? One day, Monsieur Alexandre told my mother that Lady Worlsham had called her impertinent, and therefore she had to go. That night, she sat for a long time at the kitchen table in our bedsit with her face in her hands. When I asked her the date of the signing of the Magna Carta, she hastily wiped her eyes with a handkerchief and said, as though I could remember such a thing. Then she said, "Can you take care of yourself for a moment, Anne of my heart? I need to go talk to Mrs. Stokes." The next day, when I ran home from school for dinner, she was there, talking to Mrs. Stokes and wearing a new dress, white tricotine with silver braid trim. She looked like a princess from a fairy tale. "It's easy as pie," she was saying. "I found the office just where you said it was, and they signed me right up. At first, I'm going to help with recruitment, but the girl I talked to said she thought I should be in the Rifle Corps. They have women doing all sorts of things there. I start training in 2 days. You're braver than I am, said Mrs. Stokes. Aren't you afraid of being arrested? If they do arrest me, will you take care of Anne? She asked. I know it's dangerous, but they're paying twice what I was making at the shop, and I have to do something. This world we're living in is no good. You and I both know that. Nothing's been right since the war. Just read this pamphlet they gave me. It makes sense. It does. I'm doing important work now, not stitching some lady Wordlesham into her dress. I'm with the Empress. In the end, the Empress took London more easily than anyone could have imagined. She had already taken Manchester, Birmingham, Oxford. We had heard how effective her magic could be against the remnants of our home forces. First, she sent clouds that covered the sky from horizon to horizon. It snowed for days, until the city was shrouded in white. And then the sun came out just long enough to melt the top layer of snow, which froze during the night. The trees were encased in ice. They sparkled as though made of glass, and when they moved, I heard a tinkling sound. Then she sent wolves. Out of the mist they came, white and gray, with teeth as sharp as knives. They spoke in low, guttural voices, telling the royal guards to surrender or have their throats ripped out. Most of the guards stayed loyal. In the end, there was blood on the snow in front of Buckingham Palace. Wolves gnawed the partly frozen bodies. Third and finally came her personal army. The shop girls and nursemaids and typists who had been recruited my mother among them. They looked magnificent in their white and silver, which made them difficult to see against the snow. They had endured toast and tea for supper, daily indignity, the unwanted attention of employers. Their faces were implacable. They shot with deadly accuracy and watched men die with the same polite attention as they had shown demonstrating a new shade of lipstick. Buckingham Palace fell within a day. On the wireless, we heard that the king and his family had fled to France, all but one of his sisters, who it turned out was a sympathizer. By the time the professional military could mobilize its troops, scattered throughout our empire, England was already hers to command. I stood by Mrs. Stokes, watching the barge of the Empress as it was rowed down the Thames. She stood on the barge, surrounded by wolves, with her white arms bare, black hair down to her feet, waving at her subjects. "No good will come of this, you mark my words," said Mr. Stokes. "Hush! Isn't she lovely?" said Mrs. Stokes. "You have seen her face in every schoolroom, every shop, perhaps in your dreams. It is as familiar to you as your own. But I will never forget that first glimpse of her loveliness. She looked towards us, and I believe that she had seen me, had waved particularly to me." The next day, our home economics teacher said, "From now on, we are not going to learn about cooking and sewing. Instead, we are going to learn magic." There was already a picture of our beloved Empress on her desk, where the picture of the king used to be. At first, there were resistance movements. There were some who fought for warmth, for light, who said that as long as she reigned, spring would never come again. We would never see violets scattered among the grass, never hear a river run, never watch young lovers hold each other on the embankment, kiss each other, not caring who was watching. There was the Wordsworth Society, which tried to effect change politically, and there were more radical groups, the Children of Albion, the Primrose Brigade. But we soon learned that our Empress was as ruthless as she was beautiful. Those who opposed her were torn apart by wolves or by her girl soldiers, who could tear men apart with their bare hands and were more frightening than any wolves. Sympathizers were rounded up and imprisoned, encased in ice. Or worse, they were left free, but all the joy was taken from them so that they remained in a prison of their own perpetual despair. Her spies were everywhere. Even the trees could not be trusted. The hollies were the most dangerous, the most liable to inform. But resistance groups would not meet under pines, firs, or hemlocks. In many households, the cats were on her side. Whispers of disloyalty would bring swift retribution. And many said such traitors deserved punishment. that winter was good for England, that we needed cold, needed toughening. We had grown soft after the war, allowed our dominions to rebel against us, allowed the world to change. But she would set things right. And so the resistance movements were put down, and our soldiers marched into countries under a white flag that did not mean surrender. Those who had tried to be free of us were confronted with winter and sorceresses and wolves. The chiefs and rajahs and presidents came to London, bringing jewels and costly fabrics to lay before her feet and pledge their loyalty. Our empire spread, as indeed it must. A winter country must import its food, and as winter spreads, the empire must expand to supply the lands under snow, their waters locked in ice. That is the terrible, inescapable logic of empire. I was a snowflake in a white kerchief with silver stars. Then I was an ice maiden. The other girls in school nodded to me as I walked by. If they did not wear the white uniform, I asked them why they had not joined up yet. And if they said that their parents would not let them, I told them it was their responsibility to be persuasive. I won a scholarship to university, where I inducted into the Sisterhood of the Wolf. My den mother encouraged me to go into the sciences. Scientists will be useful to the Empress in the coming war, she said. Science and magic together are more powerful, are greater weapons than they are apart. And there is a war coming, Anne. We hear more and more from our spies in Germany. A power is rising in that part of the world, a power that seeks to oppose the reign of the Empress. Surely not, I said. Who would oppose her? A power that believes in fire, she said, a fire that will burn away the snow, that will scorch the earth, that does not care what we have already achieved, the security, the equality, the peace we will achieve when her empire spreads over the earth. When I graduated, the Empress herself handed me a diploma and the badge of our order. My mother, who had been promoted to Major General, was so proud. All of us in the sisterhood had been brought to Buckingham Palace in sleighs drawn by reindeer with silver bells on their antlers. We waited in a long room whose walls were painted to look like a winter forest, nibbling on almond biscuits and eating blancmange from silver cups with small bone spoons. At last we were summoned into her presence. You have seen our beloved Princess Empress from far away, from below, while she stands on a balcony or from a sidewalk as she is drawn through the city streets in her sleigh. But I have met her. I have kissed her hand. It was white and cold with the blue veins visible. Her grip was strong, stronger than any man's, as she was taller than any man. Her face was so pale that I could only look at it for a moment without pain. Her black hair trailed on the floor. You have done well, she said to me, and I could hear her voice in my head as well as with my ears. To hear that voice again, I would consent to being torn apart by wolves. You have never seen, you will never see, anything as magnificent as our Empress. Where did she come from? Some say she came from the stars, that she is an alien life form. Some say that she is an ancient goddess reborn. Some say she is an ordinary woman and that such women have always lived in the north, witches who command the snows. The question is whispered in secret places where there are no hemlocks, no cats. Does human blood flow in her veins? Can our Empress die? I met Jack in the basic physical training program required for all recruits to the war effort. My mother had used her influence to have me chosen for the Imperial Guard, the Empress's personal girl army, which could be deployed throughout the empire. After basic training, I was going to advanced training in the north and then wherever the war effort needed me. He was a poet, assigned to the Ministry of Morale. He had been conscripted after Sirte University. This was in the early days of general conscription. He was expected to write poetry in praise of the Empress and England and those who served the empire. But first, we all had to pass basic training. We stayed in unheated cabins, bathed in cold water, all to make us stronger, to bring the cold inside us. Each morning, we marched through the woods, the long marches, hauling weapons and equipment through the snow were not difficult for me. I had been training since my university days, waking at dawn to run through the snow or swim in the icy rivers with the sisterhood. But he was not as strong as I was.
He would stumble over roots or boulders beneath the snow and try to catch himself with chilled, chapped hands. The woolen gloves we had been issued were inadequate protection against the cold. I would help him up, holding him by the elbow, and sometimes I would carry part of his equipment, transferring it into my pack surreptitiously so the sergeant did not see me. "Why are you so kind to me, Anne?" he asked me once. "Someone has to be," I said, smiling. The other girls laughed at him, but I thought his large dark eyes were beautiful. When he looked at me, I did not feel the cold. One day I sat next to him at dinner. He told me about Yorkshire, where he was born, about the high hills, the sheep huddled together, their breaths hanging on the air. "Perhaps I should have been more like my father," he said. "It was my headmaster at school who first read my poems and told me to apply for a scholarship. There I was, a farmer's son, studying with the children of ministers and generals who talked about going to the palace the way I talked about going to the store." I kept to myself, too proud or ashamed to approach them, to presume they might be my friends. But my tutor sent my poems to the university literary magazine, and they were published. Then I was invited to join the literary society. I thought it was an honor, until we all received letters from the War Office. So here I am, losing my toes to frostbite, so I can write odes for the dead in Africa, or for the war they say is coming. We all believed that war was coming. The newspapers were already talking about a fire rising in the east, burning all before it. "It's a great honor to write for the Empress," I said. "Yes, of course it is," he said after a moment. He looked at me intently with those dark eyes. "Of course," he said again, before finishing the thin broth with dumplings that we were told was Irish stew. We spent more and more time together, huddled in the communal showers when we could, telling each other about our childhoods, the foods we liked, the books we had read. We wondered about the future. He hoped that after his compulsory service, he could work as a school teacher or publish his poems. I did not know where I would be assigned. Australia, South America. There was always unrest in some part of the empire. One day, the sergeant said to me, "Anne, I'm not going to tell you what to do. I'm just going to warn you. There's something not right about Jack Kirby. I don't know what it is, but Thule, who was her wolf, can't stand him. I don't think a general's daughter should show too much interest in that boy. You don't want anyone questioning your loyalty, do you?" Her words made me angry. He was going into the ministry. Wasn't that good enough? That night we met in the showers. "I don't want to talk," I said. I kissed him, slid my hands under his jacket, sweater, undershirt. His body was bony, but I thought it had its own particular grace. He told me that I was beautiful, breathing it into my neck as we made love, awkwardly, removing as few layers of clothing as possible. "You're beautiful, Anne," I hear it in my mind, and remember the warmth of his breath in that cold place. There had been others, not many, but he may as well have been my first. He is the only one I remember. During our week of leave, he asked me to come home with him to Yorkshire. His father met us at the train station. He was a large, quiet man who talked mostly of sheep. "Look at these pelts," he told me. "Feel the weight of them. Didn't used to get wool like this in Yorkshire. It's a perpetual winter, as does it. Grows twice as thick and twice as long." But he grumbled about the feed from the communal granaries, not as nourishing as the grass that used to grow on the hillsides. Never seen such sickly lambs. And the wolves, not allowed to shoot them anymore. Those who complained were brought before a committee. We had suppers of Yorkshire pudding and gravy and walked out over the fields holding hands. I asked Jack about his mother. She had died in the influenza epidemic, which he had barely survived. That was before the coming of the Empress. I could see from the photograph of her on the bureau that he had inherited her delicacy, her dark eyes and thick dark hair. Late at night, when his father was asleep, he would sneak into the guest room and we would make love under the covers as quietly as possible, muffling our laughter, whispering to one another. The day before we were to return from leave, his father told him that Ayu was giving birth in the snow. She had become trapped in a gully and could not be lifted out in her condition. There was no chance of bringing her into the barn, so he and his father, one of the two farmhands and the veterinarian, went out grumbling about the cold. I wandered through the house, then sat in his room for a while, looking through the books he had read as a child. Books from before the Empress came and from after. Prince Frost and the Giant, the Wolf Scout series, the treasury of English poems we had all studied in school. I can't tell you why I chose to look through the battered old desk he had used as a schoolboy. It was wrong, a base impulse. But I loved him, and on this last day before we went back to the camp, I wanted to feel close to him. I wanted to know his secrets, whatever they were, even if they included love letters from another girl. I tortured myself for a moment with that thought, knowing how unlikely it was that I would find anything but old school books and pens, and then I pulled open the drawer. In the desk was a notebook, and in the notebook were his poems, and his handwriting with dates at the tops of the pages, indicating when they had been written. The latest of them was dated just before camp. They spoke of sunlight and warmth and green fields. Next to the notebook was a worn copy of one of the forbidden books, the complete poetical works of Wordsworth. I opened to the page marked with a ribbon and read, "I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils." I slammed the book shut. My hands were shaking. I remembered what the sergeant had said. You don't want anyone questioning your loyalty, do you? By the time Jack, his father, and the other men had returned, I was composed enough to seem almost normal. That night he came to my room. We made love as though nothing had happened, but all the time I could hear it in my head. I wandered lonely as a cloud, a host of golden daffodils. I remember daffodils. I could almost see them, bright yellow against the blue sky. The next morning, as Jack and his father were loading our bags into the sleigh that would take us to the train station, I told them I had forgotten something. I ran back into the house, up the stairs, and into Jack's room, then quickly slid the notebook and book into my backpack. When we arrived back at camp, I went to the sergeant and denounced Jack Kirby as a traitor. I told myself that I was doing the right thing. He would be sent for re-education. He would become a productive citizen, not a malcontent longing for what could never be. Perhaps someday he would even thank me. He was sent to a re-education camp in the north of Scotland. I graduated from basic training, went on to advanced training for the Imperial Guard, and was eventually given my wolf companion, Ula. Together we were sent to France, where the war had already started. We were among the first to enter Poland. We were in the squadron that summoned ICE to cover the Black Sea so our soldiers could march into Turkey. My dead mother had been right. Science and magic together created powerful weapons. It took 5 years, but the fire in the east was defeated, and our empire stretched into the Russian plains, into the deserts of Arabia. When I returned to England, I asked for Jack's file. It told me that he had died in the camp shortly after arriving. The causes of death were listed as cold and heartbreak. During the Empress's reign, England has changed for the better, some say. There is always food in the shops, although it has lost its flavor. Once carrots were not pale, like potatoes. Cabbages were green. They were not grown in great glass houses. The eggs had bright yellow centers, and all meat did not taste like mutton. Once there were apple trees in England, and apples, peaches, plums were not imported from the distant reaches of our empire, where winter had not yet permanently settled. There was a sweetness in the world that you never tasted. There was love and joy and pain, sharp as knives rather than this blankness. Our art, our stories, our poems have changed, become ghosts of their former selves. Mothers tell their stories about little White Hood and her wolf companion, about Corporal Cinder who joined the Liberation Army and informed on her wicked sisters. Our soldiers move on from conquest to conquest, riding white bears, white camels. Parts of the world that had never seen snow have seen it now. I myself have sent snowdrifts to cover the sands of the Sahara so we could deploy our sleighs. I have seen the Great Pyramid covered in ice and crocodiles lying lethargic on ice floes in the Nile. Our empire stretches from sea to sea to sea. Eventually, even the republics that now fight against us will come under our dominion, and then perhaps the only part of the world that has not bowed down to our empress, the wild seas themselves, will be covered in ice. What will happen to us then when there are no more lands to send provisions to the empire? I do not know. Our empress has promised us a perfect world, but the only perfection is death. You have heard stories of primroses and daffodils, and you do not believe them. You have heard that there were once green fields and rivers that ran between their banks and a warm sun overhead. You have never seen them, and you believe they are merely tales. I am here to tell you that they are true, that in my childhood these existed, and cups of tea that were truly hot, and Christmas trees with candles on their branches and church bells. Girls wore ribbons in their hair rather than badges on their lapels. Boys played King Arthur or Robin Hood rather than Wolf Scout. I'm here to tell you that the fairy tales are true, and that sitting in the secret place looking at each other in fear, wondering who among you is an informant, you must decide whether to believe in the fairy tales, whether to fight for an idea. Ideas are the most powerful things, beauty, freedom, love, but they are harder to fight for than things like food or safety or power. You can't eat freedom. You can't wield love over another. You are so young with your solemn faces, your thin bodies, nourished on pale cabbage and soggy beef and slabs of flavorless pudding. I do not know if you have the strength, but that, my children, you will have to find out for yourselves. Your leaders who have asked me here tonight believe that winter can end if you have the courage to end it. They are naive, as revolutionaries always are. Looking at your faces, I wonder. You have listened so intently to an old soldier, a woman who has seen much, felt much, endured. I have no strength left to fight either for or against the Empress. Everyone I have ever loved, my mother, Mrs. Stokes, Jack Kirby, Ula, is dead. I have just enough strength to tell you what the world was once and could be again. Imperfect, unequal, and in many ways unjust. But there was warmth and light to counteract the cold, the darkness. What do I believe? Entropy is this law of the universe. All things run down, all things eventually end. Perhaps, after all, she is not an alien, not a witch, but a universal principle. Perhaps all you can do is hold back the cold, the darkness, for a while. Is a temporary summer worth your lives? But if you do not fight, you will never feel the warmth of the sun on your cheeks or smell lilacs or bite into a peach picked directly from the tree. You will never hold each other on the embankment, watching the waters of the Thames run below. The old stories will be forgotten. Our empire will spread over the world, and it will be winter everywhere, forever. That's England Under the White Witch by Theodora Goss. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G. Hope you enjoyed that. But before you go, I have a PSA for you. The Poetry Omnibus, the poetry contest on wheels. Entry info, you can go to junopoets.wordpress.com for more information. Deadline is January 31st, 2018. Youth poetry writing workshops are hosted by local writers ages 8 to 17. They are free. Emily Wall and Monica Haygood at Douglas Library on January 17th. You can get this information on the Poetry Omnibus website. JunoPoets.wordpress.com. And Christinami Erickson, January 20th. Those are the Youth Poetry Writing Workshops. Check them out. Until next time, good night.